As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. We've reported extensively on what the invasion of Ukraine meant for its people, but less spoken about is what it's meant for the animals. Extensive damage to forests and contaminated seas have threatened the country's ecosystems and its biodiversity. And obesity is becoming a bigger problem around the world. Our correspondent takes a closer look at the data. Where is the problem worst, and is there anything that can be done about it? But first, at the beginning of the year, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and his North Korean counterpart Choe Son-hui met in Moscow. Praising the growing relationship between the two countries. The friendship goes back decades, but it took on a new significance last year when the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, went to see President Vladimir Putin in Russia and agreed to supply him with arms for the war in Ukraine. Putin is reportedly set to make a return visit of his own soon as well, the first time he would have set foot in the hermit state for 20 or so years. The deepening relationship has emboldened North Korea, and for its neighbor to the south, this is far from good news.
There's a certain amount of worry in South Korea that North Korea may be considering some kind of military action in the not-too-distant future.
Andrew Knox is The Economist's Korea's correspondent.
Kim Jong-un, North Korea's dictator, has been feeling pretty comfortable at the minute. Geopolitical tensions around the world have distracted America, and he's recently made better friends with Russia's Vladimir Putin. And this has led some people in Seoul and Washington to fear that he might soon do something a bit provocative, perhaps some sort of military action on the peninsula. And of course, given that North Korea is a country with nuclear weapons, this makes people pretty nervous.
But this is far from the first time that South Korea has felt threatened by the North.
No, indeed. And it should be pointed out that bellicose words are extremely common on both sides of the border. And in fact, there have been a few military incidents over the years. Back in 2010, when Kim Jong-un was still only the heir apparent and not quite in power, the North Koreans sank a South Korean ship and later shelled an island with artillery. And both of these happened out in the West Sea, just off the peninsula. Since then, as Mr. Kim eased into his reign, he started really ramping up military testing and developing all kinds of new weaponry. In the last 10 years, we've seen somewhere north of 220-odd ballistic missile tests, depending on how you count it, which is an enormous increase over those shot off during his father's reign. North Korea is now believed to have enough fissile material for 35 to 63 devices, according to the Institute for Science and International Security, which is an American think tank. And that's up from 5 to 13 by their estimation in 2005, just before they did their first ever nuclear test. It's also got pretty significant conventional weaponry. They're thought to be about 1,000 long-range artillery pieces that are within range of Seoul, the capital of South Korea. So when Mr. Kim makes war threats, it's perhaps unsurprising that people get worried.
So given all of that, why are people particularly concerned now?
There have been a few bits of movement in this long-standing animosity between the two Koreas, one of which is an important ideological change, which is back in December, Mr. Kim announced that a 50-year-old policy of reunification with the South through cooperation was no longer the ultimate aim of the regime. And they've also started calling Korea things like the permanent enemy. They've also returned to a claim they've been making for a long time now, which is that the maritime boundary between the two Koreas is in fact a ghost line. And recently, Mr. Kim said that encroachment into North Korean territory by even 0.001 millimeters would be considered a provocation of war. In addition to this, they launched a military spy satellite back in November, and Mr. Kim's promised three more this year. And they did a fifth test of a solid-fueled intercontinental ballistic missile. And solid-fuel missiles can be prepared to launch much more rapidly than liquid-fueled ones. Added to all this, we've been able to see from satellite imagery for a couple of years now that they've prepared the site that they have historically used for testing nuclear weapons, and they are thought to be ready to do such a test, you know, whenever it suits them.
And what about that friendship with Vladimir Putin? You're suggesting that's becoming a significant factor?
Yes, this friendship sort of sparked off back in September when Mr. Kim traveled up to Russia and the two of them met. And since we've seen a lot of traffic across the border in terms of ships and trains, they've even been flaunting this transit of goods in a sense. Mr. Kim was given a luxury Russian sedan by Mr. Putin, which the state media proudly showed off, despite the fact that this is a very obvious violation of sanctions. Much more threateningly, it's thought that North Korea is providing Russia with munitions, and it appears to be in the form mostly of artillery shells and rockets. We've already seen that some of these have been used on the battlefields of Ukraine. We assume, since, you know, Mr. Putin is not the kind of person to do something for nothing, nor too is Mr. Kim, that there's some kind of aid going the other way. That probably involves food, maybe energy, oil, and possibly even military aid, which would be really worrying since there are various weapon systems that the North Koreans haven't yet perfected, but the Russians know how to make.
Andrew, with Kim Jong-un's fighting talk, increased weapons and Russian support, how do North Korea and South Korea match up militarily should a war begin?
So in terms of conventional capacity, North Korea is still pretty heavily outgunned by the South, not to mention by the United States. North Korea's standing army is sort of just upwards of 1.1 million soldiers. But as far as we know, a lot of these aren't really combat-ready soldiers. Many of them spend most of their days laboring on construction sites or in mines. On top of that, they're pretty poorly armed, poorly equipped, and fed. On the flip side, South Korea has a pretty advanced armed forces, and it also has missile defense systems, which the North doesn't really. Of course, North Korea does have nuclear weapons, but so does America, and America has way more.
So given all of that, maybe all-out war between North Korea and South Korea is not an imminent threat.
No, I mean, one thing to note here is that all-out war would be suicide for North Korea, assuming America commits forces as it has promised to do time and time again. It's really unlikely that the regime would survive a real war. And as far as we can tell, Kim's top priority is his own survival. So it's really not in his interest to start one. But that doesn't mean there's no danger. Mr. Kim might engage in a bit of military adventurism in the hopes of driving a wedge between South Korea and the United States, since they don't always react in the same way to such things, and this can cause friction in the alliance. The final problem here is that there are no longer really any guardrails to prevent something relatively minor escalating and getting out of hand, perhaps even because of a miscalculation by one side or the other. And while there used to be hotlines connecting the two countries' armed forces, those have been dead since last April, so they really have no means of communication. With all this in mind, the risk of rapid escalation in response to a relatively minor military action is very real and could get very dangerous very, very quickly. That wouldn't just be bad for the Koreas or even the region. It would be bad for the world.
Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
In the 2 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, war has ravaged the country. Millions of citizens who fled have still not returned. Over 30,000 Ukrainian troops have been killed in the fighting. There's been untold ecological damage too. The forests and steppe have burned. Land has been trashed by tank tracks and bomb craters. And fresh water has been contaminated by explosives and chemicals. Hundreds of square miles of land surrounding the Lower Dnipro River was flooded after a dam burst. The Black Sea has been littered with sunk ships. And it's all having an impact.
When so many humans have been killed, it seems a bit frivolous to do something about Ukrainian wildlife.
Tim Judah is in Ukraine writing about the war for The Economist.
But Ukraine's environment has been absolutely devastated by the war. And when it comes to wildlife, there have been great winners and losers in this conflict. And a lot of the animals have been caught in the crossfire of the war.
Tim, which species have been worst affected?
Well, definitely worst affected, as far as we know so far, have been dolphins. Soon after the full-scale invasion began in February of 2022, Ivan Rusev, who's a star ecologist from the south of the country, began noticing dead dolphins washing ashore. Now, what he then began to do was contact colleagues around the Black Sea, and he began to look for open source information from Russia and other parts of the Black Sea as well. And what he realized and worked out with his colleagues was that up to 50,000 dolphins, that's about a fifth of the amount of dolphins there are in the Black Sea, probably died in 2022 as a result of Russian naval sonar. That bleeping underwater effectively blinds them, making it hard for them to hunt, leaves them prone to infection, which eventually kills them. They did find some had been killed due to white phosphorus, which were the type of bombs which were specially used when the Russians took a Snake Island, a sort of strategic island relatively close to Odessa. But they think that most of them died because of Russian naval sonar.
What about on land?
On land, we've had the great winners of the war, and the great winners of the war appear to be foxes. I met the head of the Ukraine's Hunting Association, and he said before the war, there were about 200,000 foxes in the country. I mean, it's hard to calculate exactly, but roughly. But he says now they think that there's about 500,000, if not more. The population of raccoon dogs, wolves, and wild boar has also gone up, but there's much smaller numbers. It's the fox population which has really exploded since the beginning of the conflict.
And why has the population exploded?
The reason for that is because since the beginning of the full-scale invasion, hunting has been effectively banned in the country. And the reason for this is very obvious, is that the authorities do not want large bunches of men dressed in camouflage and armed roaming around the country because they could be mistaken for Russian troops, or Russians might think it was a good idea to disguise themselves as hunters if they wanted to probe into certain areas. And another thing that one hunter said was, for us, it was perhaps not such a good look for people to be seen out there with guns having fun when others were dying.
But Tim, wolves, raccoon dogs and wild boar aren't usually popular with humans. So what's the impact of that been?
Well, the problem is that if you're living in a village, especially, and you've got chickens, there's a lot more foxes out there trying to steal your chickens. But there is a sort of a darker side. There have been a lot more people going to hospitals seeking inoculation for bites, either from foxes or from dogs. We're talking specifically about the problem of rabies here. In the first 9 months of last year, 40% more people than the year before sought post-bite rabies inoculations. And the fact is also that while boar numbers are going up, mean there have been more cases of African swine fever. And when there's African swine fever, all the local pigs in that area have got to be culled. Also, you've got large packs of feral dogs running about. They often eat the remains of dead foxes or dead wild boar. They can catch rabies and other diseases. So it's really a question of a disease more than a question of nabbing chickens off villagers. The president of the Hunting Association says that they have a job to do and that they don't just go hunting for the love of hunting, he says. It's because their job is to sort of control the numbers of foxes. It's because people are worried about rabies and other diseases.
And will hunting be allowed again?
Well, it's definitely not on the cards at the moment, but the Hunting Association is definitely lobbying for this. But it is quite controversial. Irina Vikrishchuk, the director of the Tuzli Lagoons National Park, says that hunters are playing up the rabies and African swine flu issues because they want to get the more or less blanket ban on hunting lifted. She says, in the context of the war, the issue of rabies is really hardly dramatic. You know, the numbers of people who've died, you could count on one hand. It's the numbers of people who've been bitten is much higher. But still, she says that thanks to the ban on hunting, she's seeing a lot more wild animals in her park and elsewhere. She's talking specifically about deer, birds, and other wild animals. So as far as she's concerned, thanks to the ban on hunting, there's been a sort of regeneration of biodiversity, and she's very much in favour of it.
Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for asking me.
It used to be that there were more people in the world with too little to eat than ate too much. But now the scales seem to have tipped.
A new study has found that 1 in 8 of the world's population are now classed as obese. That is more than a billion.
Research published in the Lancet Medical Journal shows that global obesity rates have climbed steadily higher and now significantly exceed the share of adults who are underweight. And that collective weight gain isn't just happening in the rich world.
We were able to look through a huge amount of data in this new study.
Michelle Hennessy is the Daily Charts editor at The Economist.
It's one of the largest studies of its kind. And in a nutshell, more than 1 billion people were classified as obese in 2022. Rates in adults have doubled since the 90s. They've quadrupled among children and teens. And when you put that data on a map to look at the prevalence rates of obesity around the world, you see that it's really flashing up everywhere.
So, Michelle, tell me, what exactly is the study measuring?
Well, this is a huge database and it looks at a range of issues of malnourishment. So obesity, as well as people who are underweight. Now, it uses BMI, body mass index, the relationship between height and weight, and it determines the rates of people who are obese based on higher levels of BMI. So in this study, having a BMI over 30 is considered obese. Now, that's an imperfect measure. If you're a bodybuilder listening to this, you're going to have a very low body fat percentage, but you're going to have big, heavy muscles. So that could put you in the obese category when you're clearly not. It can also vary depending on a range of things, including race as well. So type 2 diabetes, for example, is 30% more common among Asians than it is among white people. And black people with a BMI of 23 are as likely to have hypertension as white people with a BMI of 27. But it is still a really useful rule of thumb. So most studies do show that people with higher BMIs do tend to suffer more from conditions like diabetes, and it also may increase the risk of more than a dozen types of cancer. So together, these factors and other factors, obesity does kill around 4 million people each year. So that's why measuring waistlines is a public health issue.
I'm glad you mentioned that racial element there. Okay, Michelle, tell us, what has this new study been able to find?
So listeners who read the story online, they will have seen the map that we created on obesity rates globally, right? And Polynesia and Micronesia, they had the highest rates in the world. Adults in American Samoa, for example, more than 75% of people there are obese. And even countries that historically were associated with undernourishment, they are also now struggling with weight gain. So places in Africa and the Middle East as well. In the West, Turkey was the obesity capital of Europe for women. For men, it was Romania. France also stands out in Europe. They have the lowest rates of obesity for men and for women. And in America, 44% of women and 42% of men had a BMI over 30. There's also a gender gap. Women are much more likely to be obese than men. So there's a huge amount of data there, more than we can get through now.
And you mentioned that rates amongst children and teens have gone up as well. What's the study showing there?
In children, more boys are affected than girls, so it's the opposite there of adults. Obese children outnumbered underweight ones now in two-thirds of the countries that are included in this study. Now, in rich countries, this tends to be found in low-income families, but in poor countries, it's more of a middle-class problem, right? We've covered this a lot in the past, and as average incomes rise, more children are now moving into that overweight danger zone category. And that means that more poor countries now are facing this double epidemic, right, of malnourishment and then also obesity.
And why is this happening?
So unfortunately, there's not a bite-sized answer to that. That's what makes finding a solution here so difficult. So one thing, of course, is diets. If you go to your local supermarket, the cost of picking up some veggies is going to be more expensive than picking up your starchy staples, right? And then there's aisles filled with these ultra-processed foods that are super cheap. So one study looked at prices in 2021, and it found that 42%, that's 3.1 billion people in the world, could not afford a healthy diet. If you drill down into those numbers in the 10 most afflicted countries, over 90% of the population could not afford a healthy diet. And that's contributing to the higher rates of obesity. But you know, when you're talking about this many people suffering, it can't be put down just to dietary willpower. There's bigger factors at play here. One is biology. We weren't built to handle this superabundance of naughty foods. The human body evolved to survive winters and famines, to cling on to body weight and resist efforts to lose it. Like we said, there's factors of gender, there's factors of age and race, and they're all playing a part too.
Michelle, is there anything that can be done about this?
I think the short answer is yes. The longer answer is that it's going to be very difficult to reverse these trends. Everyone's talking about weight loss drugs, and they've been shown to really help people shed the pounds. But there's caveats there, of course. One is that it's prohibitively expensive. So we've said that obesity affects a huge amount of people, particularly low-income families in rich countries and people in developing countries. So the issue of price for weight loss drugs is a big one. Reversing these health trends will really require prevention, preventing more children and adults from getting fat in the first place. That will need intervention from governments, and that's something that both politicians and voters might not like.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think by getting in touch at podcast@economist.com. Guys, you only have until Sunday to take advantage of a half-price offer on Economist Podcast Plus subscriptions. That's less than $2.50 a month for an annual or a two-year plan. If you've been considering subscribing, this is a great way to finally dive in. With weekly feature shows on everything from China to the world of science and tech, to weekend shows, which explore the narratives behind the headlines, there's something for everyone. Follow the link in the show notes or search Economist Podcast Plus online to find out more. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.